The phrase conflict of interest actually comes with a ticker symbol today, XOM. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco today from the studios of KQED, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 13th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Rex Tillerson is the name. Secretary of State is the job. Word of the pending nomination came out of Trump Tower this morning, followed closely thereafter by bipartisan skepticism. There has been much talk of the personal conflicts of interest the president-elect will have once he is sworn in, about which more in a minute. But there are corporate conflicts that attach to Mr. Tillerson's nomination. ExxonMobil, the ginormous oil company of which Mr. Tillerson is presently the CEO, has billions of dollars at stake in projects and investments in Russia, interests that are, for now anyway, blocked by American sanctions against Moscow. Marketplace's Annie Baxter gets us going with that one.
Russia's energy industry is dominated by state-owned companies, but ExxonMobil is one of the largest Western companies operating there, thanks in part to Rex Tillerson. So says Emma Ashford, an expert in energy politics at the Cato Institute.
He managed to negotiate a deal with a Russian state-owned company known as Rosneft to create this joint venture that let Exxon stay in the Russian market.
That was at a time when other companies like BP were being forced to withdraw. Ashford says ExxonMobil's joint ventures suffered when the U.S. and other allies imposed sanctions limiting foreign investment in Russia. Those sanctions were tied to Russian conflicts with Ukraine. And Rex Tillerson may be too invested in lifting those sanctions, according to Robert Weissman with the government watchdog group Public Citizen. Weissman adds that Tillerson is coming from a company with its own kind of corporate foreign policy, which, Weissman says, creates conflicts with many oil-producing countries, some with corrupt governments.
Exxon's foreign policy is to do whatever it takes to drill oil anywhere it can in the world.
But David Goldwyn, a former energy diplomat under the Obama administration, trusts Tillerson's integrity and ability to set aside ExxonMobil's interests. Goldwyn is more concerned with the marching orders Tillerson will receive from his boss.
Will he protect the U.S. commitment to NATO? Will he fulfill obligations to represent human rights under the Helsinki Accords?
Goldwyn hopes to hear those questions answered in confirmation hearings. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
We are, it seems, going to have to wait a little while longer to hear about how Donald Trump plans to handle those personal conflicts of interest I mentioned. The long-awaited announcement originally scheduled for Thursday about those conflicts and how he was going to deal with them has been unscheduled January now, apparently, according to his transition team. Last night, though, in a couple of tweets, Trump laid out his plans to hand business management over to his adult sons and an executive team. He also said no new deals are going to be done. That's a quote during his presidency. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York now on what the definition of no new deals might be.
In just three words, no new deals, Trump manages to enable supporters to say he's taking action, but still be ambiguous enough not to resolve serious questions from bipartisan critics. Larry Noble is general counsel of Campaign Legal Center and a longtime government ethics attorney.
The conflict problem arises because of the deals he has right now across the globe.
Deals that are fantastically complex and frequently mysterious, including real estate, loans, and licensing agreements to put the Trump name on everything from clothes to skyscrapers in India, Turkey, and the Philippines. Those aren't new deals, and the whole thing falls flat with Richard Painter, formerly the chief ethics lawyer for President George W. Bush. He and his Obama administration counterpart Norman Eisen have a proposal that's getting a lot of attention.
Sell the assets that create the conflicts of interest. That is the deal we need to see. We need to see more deals, deals to sell these businesses in the next few months so he can be an effective president.
That's further than Seth Barrett Tillman feels Trump needs to go. The lecturer at Maynooth University's Department of Law in Ireland favors an independent blind trust over selling. And he says some critics are rushing to judgment, given the complexity of Trump's holdings.
There's plenty of time to solve this problem. He's going to rely on his lawyers and senior staff for advice. He's going to ask them to set up, if not a blind trust, something that will be significant to reduce the conflicts, and then he'll pick.
We'll see what he chooses in the coming days. But so far, Trump's latest promise of no new deals is not sealing the bargain with his critics. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
We told you a couple of weeks ago in an investigative story from R. Scott Tong and from Tom Scheck from APM Reports that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, had gotten creative in how it referred to the dangers of fracking. Specifically, the agency had said in a draft report that the controversial drilling technique had not caused widespread systemic impacts on drinking water. The final report came out this morning, and it says hydraulic fracturing, as the technique is properly known, has indeed caused contamination to drinking water in some circumstances. It's a walk back for the agency, and it comes as President-elect Trump, as we've been telling you, is appointing supporters of the oil and gas industry to his cabinet. Here's Tom Scheck.
EPA Deputy Administrator Tom Burke says the study found that not every fracking well is causing problems, but he says faulty well construction, fracking fluid spills, and drilling errors have caused contamination.
We found scientific evidence of impacts to drinking water resources at each stage of the hydraulic fracturing water cycle.
In 2015, a preliminary draft of the report caused controversy by saying that fracking had not led to widespread systemic impacts to drinking water. A Marketplace APM Reports investigation found that conclusion was inserted just before the draft's release. Burke now says that statement was removed after criticism from the agency's scientific advisors and the public.
Scientists put that language in the draft report, and scientists made the decision not to include it in the final report.
President-elect Trump has appointed oil and gas backers to the EPA, the Department of Energy, and Secretary of State. Today's decision won't matter much, says Scott Siegel, an oil and gas attorney at Bracewell LLP.
I don't think that the Trump administration is likely to be dissuaded by this one change of a phrase in a report, which is definitely a minority opinion.
But John Noel, with the environmental group Clean Water Action, says the conclusion should force regulators to pump the brakes on any new drilling.
If the next administration wants to deny science, they'll have to let a 1,000-page study that very meticulously details numerous threats to drinking water, then that'll be on their watch.
Noel wants the oil and gas industry to freeze any new drilling, a move that is certain to be unpopular with the Trump administration. I'm Tom Scheck for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I tell you what, in a different year, it would be called a Santa Claus rally. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the big Republican promises since basically the day the Affordable Care Act was passed has been to repeal and replace it. The GOP is going to have the opportunity to do so come January the 20th with President Trump in the White House, Republicans in control in Congress, and Representative Tom Price of Georgia having replaced Sylvia Burwell as the Secretary of Health and Human Services. The ACA has been a key part of Secretary Burwell's job the past 2.5 years or so that she has been in office. Madam Secretary, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I'll tell you what, I'm looking at a headline here from the Metro News of West Virginia, and it's an article about you and a talk you gave there three weeks after Election Day. And the headline is, Sylvia Matthews Burwell says stories of Affordable Care Act need to be told now. I'm wondering, ma'am, as we sit here looking at the Trump administration, whether maybe you weren't a little late to the game telling the stories.
You know, one of the things that I think has happened is now the reality of what everyone's been talking about has set in. And what healthcare in the United States and what the Affordable Care Act actually means to people. And that's what I was talking about in West Virginia, because the slogans are over. And what was happening before is there were repeal votes, but those repeal votes didn't really have meaning for the American people. And so now I think we all need to shift our attention to the substance of what this means in real people's lives.
The slogan now, of course, for Republicans, it seems to be in Congress and also for the incoming Trump administration, is not repeal and replace, but rather repeal and delay. What does that mean in your mind as the woman who's been in charge of, largely in charge of implementing this thing for the past, 2.5 years?
What I'm afraid that repeal and delayed implementation and delayed replacement means is actually repeal and collapse. And what that means is insurance companies make their decisions on rates and whether or not they're going to be in a state in the first half of the year. And with levels of uncertainty that would come from that type of a legislation, they will pull out. And then what we will see is the unraveling, the increase in rates, and the decrease in competition, and therefore millions will lose their access.
But ma'am, we're already seeing the market unravel to some degree. Insurance companies are pulling out of the exchanges because they're not able to make enough money. They're losing millions of dollars. Fair to blame that on repeal and replace in the incoming Trump administration?
I think what we are seeing is that the market is an early market, and we are now in the third year. You know, you mentioned that there were stories about how in North Carolina there were losses. Well, this year, after North Carolina issuers did some changes last year, they're actually making money in the marketplace this year. And as we look all over the country, in the state of California, in the state of New York, in the state of Florida, where there are 1.5 million people signed up through the marketplace, there are places where it is harder. In the state of Arizona, we have seen that. But for the vast majority of the country, the marketplace is working. And so the question again is making this conversation attached to the facts. And you know it's open enrollment right now. And we're up over 2 million folks who have signed up for the marketplace this year. And that's a little bit ahead of even where we were last year.
You've got, I don't even know, like a month plus left in this job. I'll ask you the same question I asked Secretary of Commerce Pritzker a couple of weeks ago. What is your biggest regret, the biggest thing left on your plate undone?
It's always great when one can get out in the country because it just keeps you close to the work. I get to do it a lot, but I would love to have been able to do it more.
You going to miss it?
I'm sure I will miss parts, and I'm sure there are other parts I will not miss, guys.
Sylvia Burwell is the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Madam Secretary, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
There are plus or minus 700,000 people in this country living and working in this economy legally as a result of something called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, as it's known, people brought here illegally as kids. The Obama-era executive order establishing that program was sharply criticized by candidate Donald Trump. Those criticisms are being soft-pedaled, though, by President-elect Donald Trump. But people who are vulnerable because of it are caught in between. Katia Garcia. Her story is today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My parents actually made the decision of bringing my sister and me to the United States because I was diagnosed with lupus. So they made that decision, you know, that maybe if they brought me here, they were able to afford more. I'm well. People look at me and they're like, okay, they don't even think that I'm sick. With DACA, you know, I was able to think a little more about my future without hitting a wall, right? Because I felt like, okay, now I have the opportunity to achieve certain things that without money, I wouldn't have been able to. I was able, you know, to find a part-time job actually tutoring at a high school, and I wasn't able to do that before. And I graduated with a bachelor in sociology. I feel like I have accomplished a lot and I have been able to help a lot of my parents. I pay actually most of the rent because my parents are struggling a little bit with money. Now it's harder to picture my future with the new election results. I feel like I won't be able to support my family anymore. We just have to stay strong and this is the time to voice how we feel.
Katia Garcia in Los Angeles. You can tell us about your economy. There's a place to do it at marketplace.org. Coming up.
Your life would clearly be less stressful and more free.
Universal basic income, perfect solution or radical idea, hmm? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 114 points today, about 0.5%, 19,911, just shy of that psychological barrier of 20K. The NASDAQ up 51 points, 9/10%, 54.63. The S&P 500 up 14 points, 6/10%, 22.71. So large gains among Dow-listed companies today. Here are some. Nike up 1.4%. Chipmaker Intel up 2.33%. Also ExxonMobil up 1.75%. Today, as we mentioned, that company's CEO likely to be the next U.S. Secretary of State. The big oil producers in OPEC pledged today to cut production, which will mean less oil to go around and therefore higher prices. Crude up 15 cents, more than a quarter point. Nearly $53 a barrel if you're keeping track. Bonds stayed about the same. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 2.47%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's entirely possible that during the mad dash of holiday travel, you are going to find yourself between flights with some time to kill and needing a gift for your Aunt Nellie. An airport might be the last place you think to buy anything for somebody you even kind of cared about, but trust me, look around. It might pay off. Barbara Peterson is the senior aviation correspondent at Condé Nast Traveler. Barbara, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
All right, so the headline on the piece is why you should do your Christmas shopping at the airport. Sell me, because, man, really?
I know. It does seem very counterintuitive. And in fact, really, most of us associate airport shopping with things like, you know, an endless array of chocolate alligators or yeah. inflatable pillows. But a strange thing has been happening. Airports have finally figured out that, hey, we have one of the most coveted captive audiences.
Captive, yeah.
Yeah, in the world, really. I mean, when you think of it. And they have not really catered to that market.
You point out in this piece that this thing that the airlines, I guess, called dwell time is up. That is to say, the time between security and getting on the plane has increased. And so we're left wandering around with nothing to do but shop.
What happened is that after 9/11, as we all know, we were all trained to go to the airport much earlier than we would have otherwise. And there's always that uncertainty about how long it'll take to clear security.
Yep.
And that has not really changed since 9/11.
Right.
So the airlines and the airports have taken notice of this. That can sometimes feel a little strange, like, oh, it's bonus time. I should be enjoying this. And yet, what do you do?
Yeah. The chains in a lot of airports, you say, are expanding inventories in time for the holidays. I mean, they know that we're coming and we're going to buy.
And that's the other thing that they've recognized, too, that if you just give people the usual junk, you know, souvenir yeah. mugs, you know, trinkets, that's not going to really translate into much. So what they've done is, first of all, get in different kinds of retailers. They're actually now almost boutique-like mm-hmm. locations mm-hmm. popping up that will sell you clothes, sell you shoes. And that's not something you expect to buy in an airport.
No, but that's also stuff you have to cram into your suitcase, too, right? So there's that.
Well, yes and no. Some of them will ship your
purchases. Oh, that's
to you.
So smart. Yeah.
And if you know that in advance, then you can sort of strategize what you're going to get.
Can we talk pricing here for a minute, please? Because every time I buy anything in an airport, whether it's a cup of coffee or, you know, I guess maybe once I bought clothing in an airport, I always felt like I was getting ripped off because they had me and my, you know, latte is $7.
That has been a persistent issue with yeah. airports. But they are aware of that. And frankly, these days with everybody waving their smartphones around and all that, you know, you can instantly check whether or not yeah. this is a decent price or not. So airports have responded. They're bringing it closer to what they call street pricing.
All right. Here comes the put up or shut up question. You're in Manhattan, right? You're in New York?
Correct.
Are you going to haul out to Kennedy Airport to do your Christmas shopping? Because I'm not going to LAX. I got to tell you that.
Actually, I was flying back to New York from Cleveland. I have to say, I love their stores there. It wasn't there crowded. Go. They had a Johnston & Murphy there.
Yep.
I went to town. You know, so it really is, again, one of those things that if you're flying through a terminal, you might almost want to arrive early.
Barbara Peterson is the aviation correspondent at Condé Nast Traveler. Barbara, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
We don't quite know yet what a Republican-controlled government is going to do with the social safety net that we've got in this country. But there has been some new-ish buzz this year about a relatively old economic idea, universal basic income, where the government gives everybody a monthly check, no strings attached, to meet basic needs. In Finland, where they plan to test the idea next year, meeting basic needs isn't really the problem. That's one of the most generous welfare states in the world, Finland is. As Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports now from Helsinki, the Finnish government is more interested in basic income as an experiment in welfare reform.
I know what you're thinking. How can giving people free money get people back to work and cut government spending? Well, first, meet Mika Valtonen.
Moi, mä oon Mika, ja mä oon 24-vuotias.
All right, and say it in English.
Hi, I'm Mika, and I'm 24 years old.
I meet Valtonen in a coffee shop near his apartment. The Finns are big on coffee, and apparently Lil Wayne, who croons from the coffee shop speakers. Valtonen has a vocational education in computer tech, but since moving to Helsinki 5 years ago, he's been in and out of jobs, on and off unemployment, and tangled with welfare bureaucrats over whether he met their job search requirements. The work he has found? Temp jobs, mostly.
And if the company says, we don't want this person anymore, you're out immediately, in one day.
Lil Wayne aside, this is what Valtonen usually listens to and produces himself. He earns a little money, all off the books, DJing and promoting Helsinki's underground techno music scene. Under current rules, if he were to report the income, he'd lose welfare money.
Yeah, if I don't get a real full-time job with a real salary that exceeds the 1,100 euros I get at the moment, then I'm stuck in this situation.
That 1,100 euros amounts to almost $14,000 a year from various government programs. Valtonen's caught in what Finns like to call an incentive trap, where working leaves you worse off than living on the dole.
I'm kind of an artist, so I also have lots of more free time to do those things, and I'm trying to make a career of that.
Over 8% of Finns are unemployed, 20% of young people. With an aging population and sluggish economic growth, Finland's center-right government is looking for ways to cut state spending and simplify welfare. A basic income could act in lieu of a maze of benefits and encourage the unemployed to take part-time or low-paid jobs, since they won't risk any money by working. Olli Kangas is leading the basic income experiment.
In the present system, they're a little bit afraid of accepting job offers, say, for 2 months or 3 months, because they think that, okay, how much would I benefit in terms of money?
Plus, there's the hassle and uncertainty of requalifying for unemployment when a job ends. Finland launches its basic income experiment next month. 2,000 unemployed Finns will get about $600 a month, no questions asked. Teuvo Tuvainen, a political scientist at the University of Helsinki, says even staunch defenders of Finland's welfare state see advantages to streamlining it, especially for the poor who have to navigate it.
It's very complicated and stressful. They put a lot of discipline on you. So if you just had basic income that would replace all this, your life would clearly be less stressful and more free in that sense.
That's the theory anyway. Olli Karkkainen, an economist at Nordea Bank in Helsinki, has criticized Finland's basic income pilot as too limited.
There are no losers in this experiment. The results are bound to be positive.
Karkkainen says, for one, it doesn't remove enough other subsidies to really test the work incentive. And it doesn't include the higher taxes needed if everyone in Finland were to receive a basic income. But it will show the choices people make with a benefit that's unconditional. Some young adults, he says, might be tempted to just live off the check under their parents' roof.
But it also might kind of make it easier to have your own small little business with the basic income. So even though you don't get that much profit at the beginning, you can do it.
Most Finns say they support a universal basic income at $1,000 a month, not $600. But when informed of the steep tax hikes required to pay for it, they balk. Apparently, even the generous Finns have their limits. In Helsinki, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Google's plan to take over the world takes another step forward. The company, which still gets 90-something percent of its revenue from ad sales, has turned its self-driving car project from a research operation to a full-fledged business division. The inference here being they think they might actually make money from it one day. Waymo is the name of the new shop. Stands for A New Way Forward in Mobility, which, meh, right? All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 114 points today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ added 51 points, 9/10%. The S&P 500 up 14 points, about 6/10% there. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes in this shot Kerwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.